walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Kristen Auerbach, who now has the Pima Animal Care Center in Tucson, Arizona. Before taking that job, Auerbach was Deputy Chief of Animal Services at the Austin Animal Center, part of a team that led the nation's largest no-kill shelter. Between her work there and her prior stint at Fairfax County Animal Services, Auerbach has become recognized as a pioneering, prominent figure in the animal shelter world. We'll hear about the path she's traveled, both professionally and in terms of geography, and the philosophy and protocols she's developed along the way for getting animals out of the shelters and into homes. I'm going to speak with Kristen Auerbach in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I'll speak with conservationist Maria Diekman, whose efforts to save the pangolin, considered the most trafficked animal on the planet, are at the center of a documentary called The World's Most Wanted Animal, airing tonight on PBS. Meanwhile, it's enormously important to mention that WMNF's Summer Fun Drive begins 1 week from today. So on the morning of May 30th, I'll be asking for you to donate in support of Talking Animals and WMNF. But it's unlikely I'll hit my fundraising goal if I don't generate some pledges before next Wednesday. So I hope you'll consider pledging, why not today? Which you can do very simply by heading to talkinganimals.net, where you can also see our special thank you gifts that you can only get by donating in support of Talking Animals. They include a pair of amazing tickets to see Paul Simon on the Tampa stop of his farewell tour, 3 copies of Aaron Greenwood's acclaimed new book, Your Robot Dog Will Die, signed by Greenwood, especially for Talking Animals listeners, tickets to see the amazing comedian, podcaster, and radio star Jim Norton, the latest version of the Talking Animals t-shirt, among other gifts, again, you can only get by pledging in support of Talking Animals. Again, please check talkinganimals.net for details on these gifts and how to pledge. Right now, though, let's get to Kristen with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Kristen Auerbach on Talking Animals. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. Bright and early your time, I know, so I appreciate it all the more.
No, I'm happy to be here.
Cool. So I'm really looking forward to exploring some of the perspectives and philosophies about animal shelters that you've developed over the course of stints at facilities, like I mentioned, at Fairfax County Animal Services in Virginia, Austin Animal Center, and of course, Austin, and before landing your current job as director of the Pima Animal Care Center. But over the years of talking with, at this point, hundreds of people on this show, I've become convinced it takes a singular personality to run a shelter, to be good at it, and to not burn out or flip out, for that matter. So let's get a bit acquainted with you. How did you first get started in this kind of work, and what drew you to it?
So I started actually in the late 90s in a shelter in Ohio where the euthanasia rate was probably 70 or 80%. And I was young in my career. I went in as a humane officer investigating cruelty and neglect and a dispatcher. And at the time, I was really dismayed and pretty horrified that every single animal I helped to save out of a cruelty and neglect situation came right back to the shelter and was killed. And at the time, we were any animal under 4 months was dying, and any animal over 4 years was dying, and any animal with any kind of medical condition also was killed. And so I only lasted in the field at that point for about 6 months. I just couldn't do it, and was also pretty devastated by the fact that all these healthy and treatable animals were dying for really no reason at all, except no one knew they existed.
Sorry to interrupt, Kristen, but I was just going to ask about that. Why was there that across-the-board loss of those animals? I mean, was there something that was just inherently wrong there?
Well, yes, it was a different time in animal welfare history. Most people didn't ever see an animal in the shelter that... So, like, there wasn't the consciousness there is today about shelter pets. Most animals were hidden in the back of buildings. You know, at this time, Nathan Winograd is working on the no-kill equation, and that sort of cultural consciousness around life-saving is just emerging. I was aware of none of it.
Okay.
And we have to remember that, I always try to remember, these institutions were founded on killing animals. They were really founded to round up dogs, bring them into the shelter. They were rabies control organizations, many of them built next to the garbage pounds and our garbage dump, and they were really dog pounds. Back then, there really wasn't a movement to change the institution that I was aware of. So I felt, as a young professional, felt really disempowered, and ended up, on my last day, I walked in and they were euthanizing my favorite dog because he needed a dental. 4 years old, and I physically ran away from that job. I never went back, never turned around, and so I swore off animal welfare for the rest of my life.
Well, not quite, I guess, but anyways. So, I mean, just so because I'm seeing a picture in my head. So when you saw that this nice, beautiful dog, 4 years old, I guess to save themselves a few bucks on whatever dental procedure was being euthanized, you literally ran out the building and just didn't come back?
Yeah, I think I knew even then that this something profoundly wrong was happening, and that it wasn't just killing the animals. It was also a human rights issue. The people that had to do this work were completely just shut down. They had to shut off all emotions, and I was just unable to do that. Coming back, the really quick story about how I came back to the field is that I was working in parks, and I went to work for a woman who, a week after she hired me, said, "Hey, I'm going to go run the animal shelter, and are you interested in applying for the?" It was some sort of assistant director job at the time, and I said, "No way!" And I told her my story, and she said, "Well, if you come and work for me, you don't have to kill animals. You can just work to save them. And the rest is history."
Yeah, well, she said the secret words, I guess, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So with that in mind, let's just take a brief detour, because I'd be very curious, especially now, to know what role animals played in your life as a kid. I mean, were you in love with animals from the get-go? Were there animals in your household growing up? Tell me a little bit about those years.
Yeah, my parents they really fostered a love of animals. And I think I bought every single pet you can buy at the pet store, and some more successful than others. But started to realize really at a young age that the way that animals were commodified wasn't good for the animals. We bought my first dog. Her name was Candy Lou, and she was a purebred golden retriever. And it was shortly after that a stray dog came wandering down the road. Definitely a must. And my family took it in. And I realized when I was a kid the difference between those two things, and really wanted to help the must. Was much more interested in that even when I was about seven.
So were you also therefore kind of the kid that in the neighborhood that tended to sicker or injured animals, birds, critters, others that sort of just showed up in the area?
Yeah, you know, I used to troll the newspapers looking for animals that needed help, and they would hide in the sale ads for puppies. There would always be an animal that needed help that somebody was trying to actually rehome, and I would always try to get those ones. And my mom said, "Two's the limit." So.
Oh, wow. So you had sort of a precocious sense of the work that you really would later do.
Yeah, I do think you're right. This work's really a calling. And I feel like from early childhood, I knew that I wanted to help animals in some capacity.
Yeah. Well, so with that in mind, then one thing to sort of be that kid and maybe even sort of a high octane version of that kid. But where along the way did you start to have a sense that I could make my living working with animals, doing some of the same things I've done as a kid, scouring the newspaper, et cetera? Or maybe I must make my living work with animals. I mean, how did that play out? When did you kind of make that turn? Was that first job that we've already heard about that kind of went badly with as a humane officer? Was there something that preceded that?
College and graduate school at Ohio State and did some totally different stuff for a few years.
Yeah.
But came back to, after graduate school, I started working as a horse trainer, and I had ridden horses my whole life. And it was in those, I did that for about 6 years. And it was in those years that I really, horse showing is it's its own kind of tragedy. And horses are made to live in little stalls their whole lives and barely have access to any movement except when they're ridden. And it really bothered me. And the longer I did it, the more it bothered me. And we did some work to rescue horses out of the slaughter auctions in Ohio. And just seeing how the industry was just using these animals up until they literally couldn't walk anymore and then throwing them on a truck where they were going to slaughter was really disturbing. And I ended up leaving the field because it wasn't clear how to intervene in that. I think for horses, we're just beginning to stand up against some of the cruelty and abuse that happens that's really normalized in the horse show world. And so when I got out of horses, made the jump into animal welfare, I feel like I had this kind of unique skill set of spending years both thinking about how structures of power work and thinking about social justice movements and also kind of knowing, having a good working knowledge of animals.
So after the stint as the humane officer didn't work out, and then this woman said, hey, come with me, you'll be saving animals. And again, those were the key words. And so there you've been, I guess, ever since. What sort of, and you've really been in, obviously, in that sort of world ever since. So what sort of temperament is particularly well suited to working in a shelter? And then part B, I guess, would be to leading a shelter.
I think it helps if you have ADD.
Okay.
Because you have to be hyper-focused on about 400 different things every single day and able to pivot really rapidly in order to address whatever crisis is in front of you. And we're still operating. Most of us are still really operating in a reactive crisis mode. But it also helps to have some strategic planning skills behind you, because we're all now trying to get, those of us leading life-saving and no-kill shelters are really trying to get out of reactive mode and think about what do we want the next 5 years to look like. Because as we've progressed towards higher life saving, we haven't really fixed the foundation in the first place. We haven't fixed the way we operate, but we are saving more lives. And so we're going back now and trying to fix that foundation. So having some skills and thinking about what we want the future to look like has also really been helpful.
Yeah, although it sounds like from what you're saying about being hyper-focused and juggling 400 things and pivoting quickly almost runs counter to actually having the sort of time and space to contemplate things in a way that's going to be more meaningful for the future.
It is true, but you know, we have so many lessons learned from human social services and from human social justice movements that can be almost directly applied to our work with animals. And so we don't really need to reinvent the wheel. What people like me need to be doing is connecting outside of our own organizations and learning lessons from those who've come before us. And one quick example is we've been looking into the history of the human foster care movement. And in 1909, Teddy Roosevelt put out this position statement that led to a large working group series of meetings. And in the statement, he said that housing children in institutions is unethical and immoral, and that the ethical, moral thing to do is to let every child live in a home, and that every child should be given the right and guaranteed the right to live in a home, not an institution. And this is where, like, the birth of human foster care happened. And by the middle of the 1900s, we had really mostly done away with the orphanage, with orphanages being the site where homeless children were housed. So we can take those lessons learned. We can take the discourse that was being used around humans more than 100 years ago and apply that to animal welfare. And we do. We say that institutions are not healthy, happy places for animals, no matter how wonderful they are. And we have in Pima one of the best shelters in the United States, but it's still an animal shelter, and animals still live in cages for 23 hours a day. And so our foster efforts are really, they're not just an attempt to build a program, but to shift the entire way we operate our organization.
Well, I definitely want to talk more, maybe now is the time, in fact, about fostering, because that seems like a pivotal part of the philosophy of the work that you've done and at Pima, but obviously before that at Austin. Let me just first let folks know this is Talking Animals, in case they're just tuning in. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just tune in, my guest is Kristen Auerbach, director of the Pima Animal Care Center in Tucson, Arizona. After stints in Austin and before that in Virginia, she's recognized as an innovator in the animal shelter world. If you'd like to ask Kristen a question about shelter, foster, adoption, anything or anything else that comes to mind, or offer a comment on those topics, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So yeah, in fact, I think it's safe to say that your sort of views and philosophy around fostering are kind of a key part of what has maybe distinguished your tenure at shelters in the past. So jumping off, I guess, from the Teddy Roosevelt called the Pioneering View in Human Foster Care. What are the critical elements of fostering in a shelter?
Well, so we started the foster journey back in 2013 when I worked for the Fairfax County Animal Shelter was under a police department, and they were very conservative and very focused on public safety. And so dogs would get euthanized for in-shelter temperament testing. They would get euthanized for any sort of behavioral challenges in shelter. And we killed this dog one day because it failed what is a standard behavior evaluation where you put food in front of them and they you use this rubber hand that looks just like a dog toy and you sort of goad them with the hand. And if they bite the hand, and this is the old school, this is luckily not happening around most of the country anymore. If you goad them with the hand while they're eating food, and if they bite the hand, they're allegedly resource guarders. And well, we've now found out that this is really completely non-predictive of future resource guarding. But at the time, we didn't know. So we killed this dog, and we just, the second that dog died, my boss and I at the time, we just knew we had done something really wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it just hit us like a ton of bricks. And we started to say, that dog's collar still hangs on my boss's door. And that dog really changed the world for us. And I think in the end, it will have changed the world for shelter pets, because we started to say, how do we intervene for these dogs that dog in particular was great with people, great, went to adoption events. How do we intervene with animals who maybe are having a hard time in the shelter or can't deal with the stress? And we started sending them to foster. So we took 50 youth-listed dogs that were behaviorally youth-listed, and over a two-year period, sent them to foster homes, and we thought we might save 10 or 20% of them. And at the end of the two-year period, we crunched all our data, and we just couldn't believe it, that we had saved over 90% of those dogs.
Oh, my goodness.
Those youth-listed dogs.
Wow.
And we were really shocked. We really thought maybe 10 or 20% we'd managed to save.
So, first of all, before we go much further, what was the name of the dog that was obviously pivotal and sort of spawned some of this work?
You know, for the first time since this happened, I can't remember her name. I'm like 40,000 dogs later.
Right. So. No. I guess that's the makes sense. But I just thought it sounds like.
I see her face.
Okay.
Yes,
all right.
I see her face in my. It's going to come to me.
Okay. Well, but I'm sure maybe before we're done talking here today, maybe you'll think of her, just because it seems like that's a name that we should know and salute in a way for what her passing did to spur you guys into doing this. So that's a remarkable outcome. And you guys must have been sort of like, holy cow, we're really onto something here.
We were, because, you know, big dogs are still what most shelters are struggling with. And we went right to the heart of the problem. Got them into foster homes. And we also followed them for 2 years, which was really critical, because there were initially so many people came to us with concerns about, is it safe? Does it work? And so we followed the dogs for 2 years and found that their placement rates were more successful than our average adoption rate. And so it was just that initial study led to Maddie's Son's Family Foundation picking it up. And we expanded that study to 6 large cities around the United States and did the exact same thing. That the preliminary results of that study are in. And they're showing us that dogs are, within a week of being in foster, their behaviors have normalized. They're significantly happier, more relaxed, calmer, better behaved, and ready to be adopted. And that they're less stressed. They show less of those kennel behaviors that get them killed in shelters. So we know now, we're learning through science and research, that foster really does work, and it works rapidly to save lives of animals who otherwise wouldn't have a chance. And that has led to us and PEMA getting a grant from Maddie's Son to build the world's largest foster program, which has foster coordinators dedicated to our groups of most at-risk animals.
So what constitutes the world's largest foster program? I mean, how is that measured?
Well, we've never had so what we're doing is we're not considering foster as a peripheral program. Most every other shelter in the United States who has a foster program, it's one of the 10. If you look at the no-kill equation, it's one of the high-volume foster adoption programs or one of the components. But for us, we're really putting foster at the heart of the work. So we're going to have four dedicated foster coordinators working full-time. And those foster coordinators are going to attempt to get about 50% of our population into foster. The largest foster programs to date have done about 2,800 animals a year, and we think that we can about double that with the resources we're going to have.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. That's remarkable. And also, I'm really struck, just because I'm still mindful of your thing about the traits that are necessary, and the first thing you mentioned was ADD and got to, like, juggle these things. But at the same time, what you've really described subsequently, for the most part, is a very sober-minded, science-based, research-oriented approach to dealing with sheltering.
Yeah, you know, I think what's happening in this moment is that we had Nathan Winograd, we had the no-kill movement come in. They made this giant, they sort of just opened the doors and broke open the institution so that we could start to ask these questions. And now we're seeing that movement merge with research and science to come together to say that not only are these practices that save lives, but they're best practices for animals and for people. We want to create safe, humane, sustainable communities, and we've shown we can do that. And through, I think I can boil everything down now, after however 6 or 7 years of doing this full time, to this idea that our role is that no animal dies an invisible death. And I know my municipal shelter takes in 17,000 animals a year. I know some of those animals are going to die. But we have an obligation to tell their stories, because it's only in telling their stories and letting the public know that we can really create change. Because as soon as people know help is needed, every single time they're there to step up and answer the call.
So, Kristen, with the research you've done and building this world's largest foster program, is there, for example, a timetable, or at least an ideal timetable, for how quickly after a dog enters Pima that dog ends up in a foster situation?
Yeah, so every shelter is different. And one of the things we're finding is that the term long stay means different things to different people. So for us at Pima, long stay is anything over 30 days. And some shelters, that's anything over 100 days. Or even 200. So we're really focused on those dogs that get stuck in the system. In high functioning animal shelters, most animals are going to move through pretty quickly, no matter what you do. The corgis and the poodle mixes, they're going to get out of your system in most shelters. But we're focused on the animals that stick around and trying to figure out what are they, and how do we intervene sooner. So how do we, from day one, flag that animal as needs foster and get it into foster, so that we're not, what happens now is that we look at a long stay list every day. So we say, okay, these 10 have been here more than 90 days. We want to intervene more quickly so that they never sit for the 90 days.
Okay. So there is a very specific practice with that, the ticking clock kind of in mind.
Yeah, because every day locked in a cage. And I ask people, imagine your own pet at home. If you took your own pet at home right now and you put it in a cage for 24 hours a day for 5 days and got it out, how would it act? For most of us, we would say my pet may very well be at risk of euthanasia after that. And so we are trying to get to those animals that decline or are going to decline sooner, so that we never have to make those hard decisions.
So let me ask the perhaps more emotionally charged question, because as you say, corgis, poodles, boom, in, out, great. But what about pit bull-like dogs? Where does that figure into this?
Well, I have really mixed feelings on this, and I was one of the people that led the efforts to remove breed labels, because they're detrimental to all dogs, not just pit bull dogs. Worked closely with Animal Farm over the years on a number of initiatives around pit bull dogs. The fact is that we have to take, anytime we talk about pit bulls, we have to take all of our emphasis off the dogs themselves and put it onto the restrictions that are applied to the dogs. And so we think, when we think about pit bull dogs, we think about how hard it is for people to get housing and own those dogs, and how they may have trouble getting insurance. And that's all based in stereotypes. It's not, it's socially constructed, but that it does impact the dogs. So we do have a harder time. And our long stay dogs do tend to be pit bull type dogs, but it isn't because there's anything interesting about the dogs. It's really the restrictions. We have 10 people a day that want to adopt a pit bull dog and can't. And we have 10 people a day that have to surrender one because they can't keep it in the housing they live in. And it's truly, I think it is the crisis of the next decade for us, figuring out how to make this not about dogs, but about these policies that really impact the dogs and end up ending their lives.
So as a guy who has a huge soft spot for pit bulls and pit bull-like dogs, I'm very interested to know how it is, or what the stories are behind the 10 people that want to adopt pit bull dogs that are unable to for one reason or another. Or did I misunderstand what you said?
Well, so I use this analogy. analogy the other day. Okay. And if you live in a community with an HOA, a homeowners association, yeah, and they tell you there's 10 kinds of grass you can plant, but you can't plant this one kind, you're just not going to plant the one kind because most people really don't care. They want grass in their yard. The people entering our shelter really don't care. They want a family dog. Don't care what breed it is. But when they call their rental company, they call their HOA, and they say, yep, you can have any dog except for this one, most people are not going to climb the hurdles it would take to get those dogs. Right. They're just going to take one of the other 10.
Sure. The next cage over. Yeah.
Yeah. And so somehow we've turned that into a narrative that there's something wrong with the dogs, when truly in 6 years, if I've learned anything about pit bulls, is that it really has nothing to do with them. It has to do with these rules that are making it impossible or nearly impossible for people to own them.
So that's really the only reason, is the people who want to adopt them but can't are just limited by living in an either overall area like Miami-Dade, which is not far from where I live, or just in it, like you say, some sort of housing complex or whatever that prevents them.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Here's something I'm really interested to know about, just your work, not just currently, but where you've been before. And just, you say, a big part of what's important to making change for you and for others is interacting with people that do the same thing and people who have different ideas and different experiences. So I'm going to guess that the culture of a shelter is crucial to it functioning at peak efficiency. How, as the leader of a shelter, do you help shape, or going into a place new, reshape that culture?
Yeah, that's a great question. And something, you know, this is my third time kind of coming in and taking over, working with the leadership team to sort of take over the culture of a shelter and refine it. Mm-hmm. Luckily, this last time around, we walked into a shelter where a lot of work had already been done there. Pima went from a 45% save rate to about a 90% save rate in 5 or 6 years.
Wow.
So it was a very rapid change.
Yeah.
And that was thanks in large part to my predecessor, Jose Ocaño, who came in and changed that culture. But one of the things that I think is a problem now for us is that animal shelter workers, particularly those that have been in the field for a long time, feel that it's a zero-sum game. Either we save all the animals and the people suffer working long hours, quote, killing themselves to save all the animals, or we indiscriminately euthanize more animals. And that has been probably the biggest obstacle. And the other challenge has been that when you do throw open the doors and you tell everybody about all the animals, there's a constant tension. Should this animal live? Should this animal die? And there are always people on either side of that. And I think for shelter directors and high life-saving shelters, it is a daily struggle to walk that line between those two camps of people and just try to focus the team, the leadership team, on doing the right thing always, knowing that not everyone is going to be happening. And whenever we talk about life and death, our highest emotions emerge. Whether those are our best selves or our worst selves, they are always there when we're dealing in life and death. And I don't think our field has really come to terms with what that means and how much it's tied up in our own trauma and why it's so emotional and why life and death decisions do what they do. I think often of how we have 1,000 people that will advocate for an animal's life and then go home and eat animals that night that want to live just as badly. And I think we have there's some really complicated issues around life-saving and animal sheltering. And we're just starting to now talk about those and how they relate to things like addiction. And so my job is to take care of the people and also to give them very clear expectations about what our policies and procedures are going to be around life-saving, adoptions, fostering, et cetera.
Well, so sort of an offshoot of the culture question, I guess, is I just have a little hypothetical just to come at this from a different angle. So let's say that the Talking Animals has a shelter. And, you know, unfortunately, it doesn't have great adoption rate and therefore maybe not such a great euthanasia rate. And so if you were coming in, like you came into Pima, and it sounds like it was already underway to making a pretty dramatic turnaround with, as you say, your predecessor, which is great. But let's say you're going in, hypothetically, for this purpose of this discussion, somewhere that's just in not good shape. So it's got, again, not a great adoption rate, kind of alarming, maybe euthanasia rate. So after forcing me out as director, which probably would be the first step, what would be the important initial steps to really trying to turn this shelter around, recognizing that these kinds of changes obviously aren't going to happen overnight? But what are the initial things that when someone steps into a shelter that kind of fits that description that really needs to be undertaken?
That's another really good and important question. And when I get all the time, we do. I have been fortunate to come into shelters that were saving at least 70% of the animals. So they were sort of on their way. But I do consult for a number of communities that are not there yet. And I was just recently talking to an advocate in a community that was meeting with the leadership team. And it's a place where I think 80% of the animals are dying in the shelter. And this advocate had really complicated the situation. I think they had a list of 25 things they wanted to change right away. And I said, don't do any of that, but go in and ask the leadership team to let you film or take pictures of the animals in the back and try to get them out. And so they did. And the leadership team of this particular shelter said yes. And that first post of those animals in the back of the of the shelter who had never before been seen probably got 100,000 views. And almost all of those animals got out alive. And that small intervention of just letting people see them completely changed the game. And I think we complicate this stuff far too much. It's a pretty simple equation of let people see the animals, tell them how they can help, and then let them do it. And it isn't rocket science. And I think one of my interests now is in developing new leaders and helping them make these simple interventions. Because I think for a long time, we've made this really hard on ourselves, and it's really not.
So with that in mind, Kristen, I mean, how much, first of all, again, let me just let people know, again, this is Talking Animals on Duncan Trust. My guest is Kristen Auerbach, director of the Pima Animal Care Center in Tucson, Arizona. We're discussing various aspects of animal shelters, and we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So with some of the things that you've said along the way, how much of your time or energy, I mean, obviously your job is director of Pima Animal Care Center, but it sounds like you spend a fair amount of time, or maybe as much time as you can, consulting or guiding other operations?
Yeah, my job is, you know, more than full-time, and it's a municipal organization, and so we don't operate in a vacuum. We operate with a whole array of other county and local government organizations. And so most of my day job is really running an organization. I'm in a top life-saving municipal shelter. My kind of volunteer service to this movement is to help other people who are trying to improve the lot of animals, improve the lives of animals in their communities. And so I do that through my work with national organizations, through speaking at conferences, and just through talking to shelter directors and advocates who want to help. So, and I think all of us now who are doing this work and know the formula are scrambling. My colleague Ellen Jefferson in Texas is gone from Austin to wagon wheeling out and trying to help all of Texas come up and be no-kill, which is Texas is one of the hardest states for animals. So her work is really extraordinary. But all of us are scrambling to help other communities because we know the answers now, and they're at our fingertips, and they're pretty easy.
It is interesting, especially with a state like Texas and some of the challenges there. I mean, I guess that's what probably struck so many people, including me, about what happened with your, and not just you, but you were sort of pivotal in what happened at Austin Animal Center over the years, just because, I mean, I know Austin is its own special city, and I have very strong ties to it. But just Texas generally is often a rough go for animals, animal welfare. So was it just because you and other like-minded folks were working together that it was almost like an oasis of what was happening at Austin against the backdrop of the rest of sort of what often happens in Texas?
Yeah, you know, so Dr. Jefferson and Ryan Clinton were both in Austin, and they're really the pivotal figures, the key figures who changed the game there. And they just said no, they just stood up to what was happening in their city shelter, both initially acting as advocates. And Dr. Jefferson will forever be my hero because she put her money where her mouth is and started an organization. And the organization she started was fundamentally different than the Humane Society model, which pulls the more adoptable animals out from high kill shelters. She started the opposite type of organization where she pulled the animals that were dying. She only focused on the animals dying in the shelter. And so till today, Austin Pets Alive takes out the 3,000 animals from the city shelter that will face killing or euthanasia and save them. And it's a model that is now being replicated around the country because those are the animals that really need the intervention. Like I said, the puppies, the kittens, or the older kittens, I should say, the more purebred type dogs, those are going to leave the shelter. It's these neonatal kittens and medium and large mixed breed dogs that really need the help to get out alive.
Well, that sounds remarkable. And there's, as with anything, it just takes some pioneers and some people just saying, hey, I'm going the other way to really make inroads. And that's often where really profound change happens. By the way, one of the emails that came in just says, thank you for your amazing work, Kristen. You're filling, I assume it means me, there's a word missing, I think, but you're filling me with hope for shelter animals, exclamation mark. So that's great.
Awesome.
So let's get a caller in before we have to say goodbye. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Kristen Auerbach. Ooh. Hello, it's you.
I didn't mean to get on the air.
Ah, okay. Well, thank you for calling anyway, then. So here's the thing. We're in our final moment or two, Kristen, but you kind of alluded to filming the animals that kind of never got seen, and this made me think, how much has social media shifted the sheltering landscape?
It's completely changed the game for us.
Yeah.
I mean, before it was news, it was the days of, like, advertising for animals in a newspaper and hoping somebody turned to that page. Social media has completely changed the game, and people like Erin Greenwood writing at the time that she did were also incredibly game-changing because no one was telling the stories. And Erin was one of the first people to tell the stories of individual animals, and it's changed the world for us. And social media brings its own set of challenges, but truly it has played such a key role. And we ask one thing everyone can do, follow your local shelter on social media and share the post. If there's nothing, no other way you can help the city shelter, do that, and that alone will save at least 1 to 2 lives per person who shares those posts every year.
Well, first, you know, preaching to the converted about Erin Green, we're a huge, huge fan here, and she's been on the show a number of times. Two, so apart from just sort of liking or following your local shelter, I mean, what else has really happened? I mean, how has social media really affected adoption of foster meds? Is it just because those animals are just in front of us or in our feed every day, or is there something more?
Yeah, it goes back to this idea that if an animal is going to die, we don't want it to die without an advocate. We don't want it to die invisibly. And so even animals, when you look at these lists of animals that are dying in shelters and you get these at-risk lists, those animals are being seen by someone. And 9 times out of 10, someone reaches out to help. They're not always successful, but we're inching closer and closer and closer to every one of those animals. They have to be seen in order to be saved. And so social media is really, really important.
Yeah, very cool. All right, well, we have just about reached the end of our time. So we've been speaking with Kristen Auerbach. She's, again, the director of the Pima Animal Care Center. The website for that facility is, I think, webcms.pima.gov. And speaking of social media, she is on Facebook and other social media platforms. There's a last-minute call here. Let's see. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Kristen Auerbach. Okay. Well, that's consistent. Okay. So anyways, Kristen, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. And thanks for all your great work helping all those many, many animal friends of ours.
Thanks, Duncan.
Thank you.
Okay.
In a few moments, I'll speak with Maria Diekman, whose efforts to save the pangolin, some say it's the most trafficked animal in the world, are at the center of a PBS documentary airing tonight. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner. Hannibal Buress may be forever known as the comic who called to attention Bill Cosby's transgressions, most famously noting Bill Cosby is a rapist. But Hannibal is also a first-rate comedian we occasionally feature here. So this is Hannibal Buress with a piece called Pigeons Get Murked. In today's Comedy Corner, on Talking Animals.
I have weird aspirations, like I really want to kick a pigeon. Because pigeons walk around like they're untouchable, like you're not untouchable, I'll get out of you. You're not waiting for the bus because you can fly. But I can't kick pigeons because there's always people around. If I kick one, some lady will see, like, oh my gosh, that guy just kicked a pigeon in broad daylight. And she goes and tells her husband, honey, I saw this guy kick a pigeon in broad daylight. Her husband tells his boss, my wife said this guy Kicked a pigeon in broad daylight. His boss knew somebody at the paper. They seen, you know, front page of the Tribune. Black dudes are kicking pigeons. There's been a flurry of pigeon kicking going on in the black community. Must be stopped at once. Save the pigeons. Must stop these PKBPs, pigeon kicking black people. Save the pigeons. Acronyms are always hilarious. I don't know why I want to kick a pigeon. I just figure to make my day better. Somehow I kick a pigeon in the morning, something bad happens that evening. I'm like, you know what, that happened. But I kicked a pigeon earlier as she was relaxing and invigorating. It's impossible to kick a pigeon, they're too quick. I tried different strategies. I tried to like side swipe, kick a pigeon and shit. I tried to punt one. I set up cardboard and act like I'm a breakdancer, street performer. And try to hit them with like a... But they don't buy that. They know all the gimmicks. That's why I want to have the Pigeon Kicking Olympics, where you get judged by the distance that you kick the pigeon, the number of feathers you kick off the pigeon, and the octave of the squawk. When you kick the pigeon like a high pitch, like, ooh, that's a gold medal. You kick out of that pigeon, you're a goddamn warrior. You deserve your own statue in a park, like, yeah.
That was Hannibal Buress with a piece called Pigeons Get Murked, taken from his album My Name is Hannibal. Okay, on to Maria Diekmann about her efforts to save the pangolin is captured in a documentary called The World's Most Wanted Animal. It's airing tonight on PBS. Speaking to us from Namibia, no less, this is Maria Diekmann on Talk Animals. Good morning, Maria, or good afternoon, I guess, or evening, your time.
Yeah, late afternoon my time, but good morning to you.
Oh, great. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. So I'm going to guess even some serious animal lovers like those who listen to the show may not be entirely familiar with the pangolin. Can you give us a brief description?
Yeah, I think most people aren't familiar with the pangolin. You know, that's why it's become so endangered so quickly without anyone really even realizing it. It looks a lot like your American anteater. It's got scales, so it's the only mammal in the world that is completely covered with scales. And it looks like a little T-Rex, if you can imagine that. It walks on its hind legs, quite an endearing little animal, and quite a sweet little animal. Doesn't do anything to anybody.
Yeah, funny, the description I made in watching the documentary, I was really struck by, we'll get into Honeybun in a moment, but just the footage of Honeybun and the way she was moving, it seemed like something out of an unlikely hybrid of Jurassic Park and the Muppets. I mean, this sort of very dinosaur-looking creature, but super cute and cuddly at the same time. So how did you become so passionate about them? What introduced you to their world and obviously you took to them?
Well, interestingly enough, I was actually born and raised in the United States. And after I completed university, I came over to Southern Africa to look at the political situation. I was involved in politics and interested in politics. And ended up in Namibia, and Namibia was just becoming independent, and I ended up staying here. So my passion has been endangered animals. I run an organization called the Rare and Endangered Species Trust, and we sort of work with all those animals that have been, you know, lesser known, sort of forgotten, the vultures and the bats and, you know, not generally the high profile animals. So penguins were always on our list until recently. So little was known about them that nobody even really knew they were endangered. And, you know, they've been one of our animals for the last sort of 18 years. And suddenly, luckily, they're getting the attention that they need because the situation's actually quite dire for their population.
Yeah, I have to say that even as someone who follows animal situations and issues and pretty closely, to learn that they're more trafficked and I guess therefore more poached than even rhinos or elephants caught me off guard.
Well, you know, as researchers, it caught us off guard. I have to be really honest, you know, still, even as researchers, we know so little. The statistic is actually now that more pangolins are trafficked every year than elephant, rhino, and tiger combined.
Oh, my goodness.
So the statistic is actually quite bad. For an animal that has never, our Cape pangolin, has never, ever been bred in captivity. So it's not that we can boost the populations with captive animals, either in zoos. No Cape pangolin have ever been held successfully in a zoo. You know, there's 8 species of pangolins around the world. Our Cape pangolin seems to be the hardest to keep in captivity, but none of them are easy. So we've got a pretty dire situation. And what happened was a lot of funding came in to start looking for elephant trafficking and rhino trafficking. Ships were being stopped. And instead of finding all of those other items, they started finding tens of thousands of tons of pangolins. So it threw us off. I mean, until 2015, internationally, the pangolin was considered what we classify as a least concern animal. That means nobody really thought it was endangered. And that was simply, just virtually a couple of years ago. And now suddenly it's considered the most trafficked animal in the world.
So were those earlier findings not accurately reflecting what was going on, or has the surge in their being trafficked really been that dramatic?
It's been a little bit of both. I think shipments weren't being stopped before, so people thought that some animals were leaving, but, that it was mainly the Asian pangolins that were getting poached and not our African pangolins. But also within sort of the last 2 to 3 years, the trade has boomed. Rhino horn has become harder to get. Pangolin scales are keratin. So they're the same as rhino horn, but they are exactly the same as our fingernails. So chemically, if you grind rhino horn or cook rhino horn or ingest, pangolin scales. If you ingest pangolin scales or grind pangolin scales, it's 100% the same as just cutting off your fingernails and or chewing them chemically.
Yeah.
So, we're trying to get that out to the Asian market. But the problem is, historically, there are beliefs that these scales have powers. And most recently, it appears that many people are considering it a cure for cancer, which has not been proven scientifically at all. And as I say, if it ever were to be proven scientifically, then your fingernails would be a substitute for the pangolin scales. So there's really, really no need to take these pangolins out. But it's an ancient culture, and there's ancient, very widespread beliefs that are hard to break.
Yeah. Well, once again, we see this Asian medicine practice that decimates a population of an animal. So You alluded to, you can't breed them in captivity. You can't really keep them in captivity. And I think the film at one point notes that it's next to impossible, I guess, for them to survive in captivity. You're one of maybe three, I think it said, in the world that's been able to beat those odds.
Yeah.
Why is it so difficult? What is it about the pangolin that makes them so kind of fragile in that way?
Well, like I said, some of the pangolins, especially in Asia, seem to be able to be held in captivity better. They've got better food sources. They've got ant eggs that they can reliably get off the market and feed the pangolins. And they've managed to come up with some diets, some artificial, that work very well. Our Cape pangolin, we're not quite sure why, but it's virtually impossible to hold in captivity. It will literally, it's such a shy animal, and it's so terrified of people, that it will literally roll up in a ball for 2 weeks and die rather than try to uncurl and get away. It's just a very, very fragile animal. And it's interesting because it's probably one of the oldest animals still alive. Pangolins and crocodiles are two of the most ancient animals still surviving in today's world. So they've survived all of these historical moments throughout the world, and suddenly man is the only thing that can decimate them within a couple of years, because it's really nothing eats pangolins or nothing kills pangolins in the wild other than humans.
Well, we're sort of nearing the end of our time, Maria. We're not really going to be able to discuss Honey Bun, but that'll be something people can look forward to seeing as part of the film, because that's a central element of the film. So just want to let people know, again, that it's Nature. I think it's the season finale, but it's the film's called The World's Most Wanted Animal, and it airs tonight at 8 p.m., I think at least Eastern Time, on your local PBS station. And Maria, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us a little bit about pangolins and about the film tonight.
Thank you, Duncan, and thanks to the listeners for listening.
Absolutely. All right, take care. Thank you. I'm Duncan Strasser, listening to Talking Animals. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity, kicking off a 3-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the new hour Midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over an executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott in the All Souls edition of It's the Music. I want to again remind you that next Wednesday, 1 week from today, we start the WNF Summer Fun Drive. So, fabulous Laura Taylor will be joining me in the studio as always, as we try to raise money on Talking Animals as part of day one. So I urge you, maybe even beseech you, to try to pledge before that. Like, why not again today? Just visit TalkingAnimals.net and you'll see our special exclusive thank you gifts for pledges at various levels and instructions on how to donate in support of us, whether or not you're seeking a gift, a thank you gift. So we'll speak to you then, and also invite you to visit TalkingAnimals.net just generally for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there as well. Also links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally, and follow me on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our e-newsletter. Find out more about guests a couple of days beforehand. Other news from the Talking Animals world, all found at TalkingAnimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind animals. Be kind others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond. Community Conscious Radio, homegrown handpicked music and news. Rob Loy is up next after NPR News. Headlines coming up presently. Thanks.